Hello and welcome to episode 250 of the Waters Wavelength podcast. I'm your host, Wei Shen, and today I have Joanna here with me. Hey, Joe, how are you doing?
Ask me later. It's 8 o'clock here, Shen. This is very early for me.
I never win, you know, like...
yeah, you don't.
Yeah. Every time I'm on the podcast, it's either Tony or you, and Tony's like, it's 1 a.m. here, you know, and then you... I mean, but Tony's kind of like the outlier, I guess. He's the weird one here. We have a guest for you listeners today. We have Enrico Bruni. He's the managing director and head of Europe and Asia at Tradeweb. And he spoke with me about electronification in the repo space. But before we get into that, Joe, I know you just got back from your holiday. How's the week back been?
It's mostly scrambling to... come up to date with all the things that happened while I was away, which was just a small news event. Russia invaded Ukraine. I feel like I haven't really had a holiday, but it was lovely. I was in Tyrol, which is a region that is in both Italy and Austria, and I was in both sides of it. I went to see a friend on the Austrian side, and then I went skiing on the Italian side. And yeah, it was lovely. I just love Italy. It's just so beautiful. The food is always really good. Mm-hmm. And the region where I was, I'd never been before. It's kind of quite unique because it's sort of a mix of Austrian and Italian culture. And the government's made a big effort to kind of make all the languages in the region equal. So everyone speaks either or both Italian and German. And then all the food is like a kind of mix of Italian and German. Austrian. And then there's a language called Ladin, I think it's how it's pronounced, which is only spoken in kind of a few valleys in the South Tyrol, and they're trying to preserve that also. So, yeah, a little lesson there for us about including other cultures or something. I don't know if we want to talk about COVID-19 on the pod. It feels a bit boring to be doing this in 2022, but it was really, it was quite a big feature of my trip because it was the first time I've really traveled since February 2020. And I haven't, you know, I've never worn a mask on the plane or had to sort of show vaccine credentials along with my passport and that we're going to go through borders. But it was just quite striking how, and this was another kind of news event that happened while I was away and then I had to kind of adjust to when I got back. When you're in Italy and Austria and Germany, which I was very briefly, you can't do anything without a mask or without what they call their super green pass, which is the kind of Schengen equivalent to our NHS COVID pass. It's like a QR code. You have to like scan it every time you go into a restaurant. But they are super strict about it. You have to, whatever you want to do, gym, restaurants, if you want a ski pass, anything. You can't function normally unless you're vaccinated and you have one of these little passes. And then I came back into the UK, and in the time that I was away, the government's lifted the mask mandate completely. So like on the train back from Gatwick, everyone's just coughing on each other and like licking the poles again. It was such a culture clash. It was quite destabilizing for like the trip back from Gatwick. I mean, there were people like staring at me with my mask on and kind of going, wait, what are you doing with your mask on? Like, lame. Now England's just, I mean, the UK is basically just acting like there's, that COVID's gone. So yeah, but I hear that's not the case in Hong Kong.
No, and I don't know how it would feel to go to a place where masks aren't being worn. I don't know. It's become such a part of our, I guess our daily attire, that to take it away now would be kind of weird. I mean, of course, I don't like wearing them, but, you know, it's just like, when we first started, like, I definitely left my apartment building without a mask, like, accidentally. But now that doesn't happen anymore. Like, if I go outside without it, I feel like I'm naked.
You feel naked, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's so weird how like it's how things have moved. And well, I'm not going to go into the details of how Hong Kong is handling the new Omicron wave. Well, not new anymore, but it's not great. So I'm just going to leave it at that because going into it will just ruin my whole week. So
but I heard you guys had like panic buying and stuff again. I mean, it feels like 2020.
Yeah. Yep, again. So even yesterday or the past couple of days, like the supermarket shelves were all emptied out. Even if you were to buy online, I think some some vendors, I guess, were saying that, "I'm so sorry, we have to cancel your order. We don't have enough stock. So just bear with us," that kind of crap. But yeah, all good. you can still get food somehow. It's just that you have to be a little bit more adventurous, or maybe venture a little bit further, go to a few supermarkets instead of just one. Yeah, all of that sort of jazz. So,
oh my gosh, it just sounds like yeah, the beginning of COVID again. Oh well, we won't go into it.
But it's just strange how people start to panic, and I mean, lack of information or clarity from the government just results in that. Even though there's nothing being done as yet, there are no confirmed rules or like timelines on certain things that the government wants to do, but yet people are like panicking, lining up and emptying shelves at supermarkets. So that's great.
Come spend some time here. We have fixed the problem. It's all gone away.
COVID yeah, no I'll have exists. To, everyone will be staring at me too, with my mask on. So yeah, I'll have to deal with that.
I hate them because like my glasses messed up. But on the other hand, like I had this really terrible pimple on my chin for the whole of last week, and it was so great just to be like, oh, I don't have to worry. Who cares? No one will see it.
that's great for all listeners. Anyway, let's get to the interview that I had with Enrico. Yeah. It's we had a lot of fun too. So we'll go to that, and till the next time. See ya. All right, today we have Enrico Bruni, Managing Director and Head of Europe and Asia at Tradeweb, joining us on the podcast. Hi Enrico, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
All good. Hi, Weishen, and thanks for having me. I'm very good, thank you, and very, very excited. I'm a big fan of podcasts in general, and me doing one, it's very exciting. So thank you for the opportunity.
No worries. Well, before we delve into our topic for today, I mean, could you perhaps tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your remit at Tradeweb?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been at Tradeweb for a long time. I joined the company in December of 2002, which makes it almost 20 years, which is in itself a bit scary. But it was a very fun ride. It has been a very fun ride. My job at Tradeweb is to be responsible for the business that we call the international business. So Europe and Asia, emerging markets, also, I help coordinating our, data strategies. So that's kind of my holistic remit.
That's interesting. And maybe we could get into that a little later on into our topic as well. So today we're actually going to be talking about electronification in the repo market space. To start with, perhaps could you give an overview of the current state of electronic trading in the repo space? I mean, how does it vary from like other fixed income markets?
Absolutely, yeah. Repo is like a really interesting market to electronify. It's somewhat personal to me as well, because I started my career as an intern on a repo desk in Milan, on one of the US banks a long, long time ago. So there's a little personal element as well. I would say repo is an interesting market. It's because it's essentially the, people would say the plumbing, I like to use more the bloodstream of bond markets, right? An efficient bond market is only as efficient as an efficient repo market. So allows people to fund their longs and cover their shorts and stuff. So it allows participants to use leverage and amplify volume. So that's essential part of the market. It's interesting, it's quirky, particularly the space on which Tradeweb operates in the dealer to client space here in Europe. And it's because this part of the market has been slower to electronify for a reason. There's a lot of different flavors of repo execution. There's a lot of different type of repos. repo reverse repo, buy sell back is a special repo or a general collateral repo, tri-party repo, open-ended repos with midlife events. I mean, it's complicated, and hence he has kind of fallen a little bit behind. Also, in the dealer to client space, the repo market tends to be non-cleared, and therefore there's a credit element to it. At the end of the day, if you were to kind of imagine or conceptualize a repo, it's a collateralized loan, you know? So there is a credit element, and being bilateral, there's an element of credit and documentation as well that complicates the workflow. And so these are the reason why the market, we think right now in Europe, is only single-digit electronic, you know, mid-single digits. It's difficult to estimate, right? But it is, we think it's a mid-single digits. And also, at this point, we are at early days, although our numbers are growing very, very significantly. We have, you know, now 41 liquidity providers on our repo platform, and we had outstanding balances of 818 billion in 2021, which is an increase of 33% year over year. So it is moving, but it's still like there's a lot of work to do, and like the universe of participants is growing fast, but it's still fairly concentrated in like the most kind of specialized players.
Okay, I mean, you said that there's a lot of different flavors, and you mentioned, yeah, the different types of repos, right? I mean, which ones would you say are the easiest, or are the easiest to electronify, or is there a higher demand for that specific type of repo to be electronified first?
Yes, it's a great question, and one that allows me also to some parallels on. This is not the first time we launched a repo platform in the direct-to-client space in Europe. We had our first attempt in 2009-10 or something like that. And we tried to do too many things at once, right, among other things. And it wasn't a great timing anyway, but also we tried to do too many things at once. In this second effort, which we started a couple of years back, we decided to take more of a call it a reverse onion approach. So we start with the core, and then we add the more complex layers. So we started with the plain vanilla reverse repos, and we were looking at automating a very specific workflow of lists of repos, right? So in order to facilitate the execution, right, to standardize the communication layer between the buy side and the sell side, and allowing the buy side to communicate more clearly, what they wanted to, borrow or lend, and also to which accounts they wanted to have that borrow lending, and the sell side to be able to digest its information digitally and therefore price it more effectively. And then as I said, little by little, we're adding layers to the element. Now, to answer your question, the most complex elements are the open-ended repos, because they tend to have what people call midlife events, right? So re-rating or early closeouts and so forth. So that changes the state of the transaction during the course of its life, and hence it's a little more complex as a workflow to manage, but it's something we are bringing to market very soon. We do believe that repo is an exciting marketplace for us, because it's dear to client space, not electronic, as I said, in contrast to the dealer-to-dealer market, which is very electronic and in the US. And so we think the opportunity is great, really exciting, therefore the transformation, and we like to transform markets for the better. It's a little bit what we kind of do. So we're putting a lot of investment in it, we'll continue to do so in the next coming months.
Okay, interesting. And I would like to come back to the investments that Tradeweb is actually, putting into this space. But before that, I mean, talking about the barriers itself, I mean, from the client perspective, because this is, as you mentioned earlier, the D2D market is very electronified already. This is you're basically targeting the dealer to client portion of it, right? So what are, some of the major barriers that currently exist, or that, you know, hinder additional electronification, you know, to certain repos?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, and to your point just now, there's a lot of different types and there's a lot of different workflows than in the execution process. And execution is also complex because it's not just the moment when you agree on the transaction, but it's what happens before the transaction on the pre-trade side and what happens afterwards on the post-trade risk management, but also most importantly in repo on the settlement side of things, right? And so there's a lot of work it needs doing. So the more complex the transactions, the more complex the workflow, the more you need to kind of work in partnership with different parts of the ecosystems to make sure that that execution value gets captured to the max when also the pre-trade element, so call it the OMS connectivity, for example, or the post-trade element, the whole like settlement piece and risk management that gets also automated. So there's a lot of work we do with our partners in the OMS community. We've been working, we do have like some cleared repos workflows on, so work with, you know, in this case with LCH a couple of years ago to bring this to market with a couple of clients here that, you know, have been driving that change. So we tend to be fairly agnostic on pre-trade and post-trade because we believe that the end-to-end workflow is really what maximizes the value of the execution at the end of the day. So.
Okay. So since you mentioned the OMS players, I mean, what is their involvement in this? I mean, exactly, what is the role that they play here? I mean, obviously, they play a huge part in the execution because that's what they do, you know, but what should they be doing more, I guess, to help facilitate, electronify this space? Or I guess, to that point, certain elements of this space at the moment, maybe the less complex repos, for example.
Yeah, it's like it's all about connectivity, right? At the end of the day, like it's about connectivity and then enhancing that the spectrum of what can be pre-trade, connected from the OMS to the venue, and then post-trade consumed from the venue to the OMS. And really, it's fairly a standard workflow in one way, but also because repo is so quirky, it needs a lot of customizations, and so keeping that pace is what we are working with in partnership with the OMS community, as I said, downstream, it's very exciting. It's very exciting because it is a market with a lot of problems to solve, and we like to kind of get into those, you know.
Okay, could you give me, I guess, maybe one or two examples of some of those problems and I guess the work that you do with the other partners in the ecosystem? Like you mentioned, you do work with the OMS providers as well as the clearing partners like LCH, right? So how, give me a couple of examples of how that, how you work together to solve some of these issues.
So maybe I can go back to the early days of the revival of this platform right now. So 2017, when we sat down with, you know, some clients on buy and sell side. And really, I would say there were two problems. One around scaling. Activity was getting higher and higher. And with the higher activity, there's a particular in like a repo that is a somewhat complex workflow, as we said, carries higher operational risk. And therefore, there was a need to that. And another need was for the particular sell side banks to be able to capture the information effectively and being able to, for example, take a full advantage of netting opportunities and therefore better pricing for customers, right? And you can only do it in a structured communication layer like what the venue provides, right? And so that was one of the earlier problems. And in a way, that's at the core of everything. It's just now we are bringing the solution to different layers of the onion, right?
Mm. Okay, I see. So, I mean, but also you did mention that, you know, some repos are cleared, some are not cleared. I mean, does that actually add to the complexity or is that changing? Are there more repos that are being pushed to clear now? I mean, what is it? And if so, what is driving that?
Yeah, so the element of bilateral execution in a credit, in some more credit intense product, it makes the workflow more complex. So having said that, we have developed tools to allow that execution to occur, obviously based on the, you know, the growth of the platform is functioning, is efficient, but certainly like clearing adds another level of standardization in the credit risk management, in the documentation layer as well. And that standardization helps electronification. There are a bunch of initiatives that the industry is working on, some which we are working on with some partners which are cooking right now. And that will help towards, addressing this aspect in the marketplace. So more news to follow on this. Hopefully the listener can stay tuned on this. There's a bunch of initiatives on that, in that space we are running together with other parts of members of the ecosystem.
What are, if you could give some examples of that, I mean, some of those initiatives that are currently happening?
We are looking at particularly the post-trade element. Of it and how we can make it more efficient. In the context of there's an increased focus on post-trade, given the CSDR regulation that's come into place. So there's focus on fails and fails penalties and so forth. And so we are looking at ways to improve the process. But that's all as much as I can say at this point.
Okay. Sure.
At least you have an element of surprise, right?
Maybe we'll get you back to talk about that when once it is, fully out. I am curious. I mean, is there a difference between the, or I'm sure there's a difference, but what are the major differences between the electronification in the repo space, you know, from in Europe versus the US and in Asia?
So Europe and US are very much in parallel. Both European market and US market are highly electronified from a market structure perspective, highly electronified in the dealer-to-dealer space. And I would say we are at the same pace with our US colleagues. So in fact, our repo platform is truly global. We get any bond you can trade on the platform, you can repo on the platform, assuming we support the workflow. As I said, you know, there's more to come on that front. But so I would say US and Europe are very much in parallel on that. Look, the markets are different. There are different types of repos that are more frequent. There's different kind of maturities that are more popular in one market versus the other. But Europe, US are very much in parallel. Asia is a bit behind. It's a market we are looking at to develop. It's technically possible, but it's not alive yet, if you know what I mean.
Electronically. Okay. So as a self-proclaimed market structure geek, I mean, since Asia is lagging behind in that sense, what is being done? What are some of the initiatives maybe here in the region, in the Asia region, you know, that are, you know, trying to push that forward?
Yeah, we're concentrating on the easiest market to electronify. So for example, the JGB market, we have some interesting volume coming out from the JGB market. And really it's like back to basic blocking and tackling and behavioral change, right, is what we need to do in those circumstances. Really show the benefit of the electronification to the marketplace and keep that momentum going by targeting, clients on buy and sell side that have similar problems that we have observed elsewhere. And really it's behavioral, right? It's a lot of behavioral change because it's so, I said, quirky, complex. I always like to say there's nothing simple in Ripple land. There is, you know, there is an element of more work to be done to shift the habits, right? And so that, but that goes back to blocking and tackling, exactly.
But that's also in parallel with the bond markets here, right? As an electronification of just in general bond markets in Asia. I mean, it's still, I mean, bond markets all over the world has lagged behind, you know, yeah, equities in the electronification side of things. So, but in Asia, it is I guess lagging even more than it's than the European and US counterparts, right? So, is it you would say it is parallel to that? I mean, if you were to compare bond markets and repo and in these different regions,
100%. Yes, that is a very strong parallel. You are 100% right. And as the if anything, and it's true actually, the repo is lagging the electronification of bond markets. You know, in Asia we've seen a significant pickup of electronification rates in, you know, in multiple markets. I mean, of course, we were one of the first in kind of the China Bond Connect channel.
Not the that's first. Right.
So that's yeah. All electronic. And the other channel we worked on, two channels we work with in China, the CIBM Direct and the Southbound channel, they're also fully electronic. Apart from China, there's like a lot more going on in the region electronically, both in some government bond markets, Japan, Australia. But frankly, we're seeing a pickup also in, you know, kind of Southeast Asia, Hong Kong and Singapore, as well as like obviously the credits, the credit market invested in inverted comma, the hard currency issued kind of bonds. The activity is growing in China, and we're starting to see clients coming to us to take advantage of some of the innovation in Europe, to your point. And in the US into Asia. So we're starting to see interest in portfolio trading, for example, in the hard currency space in the Asia region. And you know, that's been a great, you know, story for us in the US first and in Europe afterwards. And I think it's moving east, the portfolio kind of execution style. So it's great. So I 100 long-winded way to say I agree with you 100%.
Okay. And then just coming back to the investments that Tradeweb is making, I mean, in terms of, I guess, maybe the roadmap for 2022, what are some of the investments that you guys are making towards the platform itself? Are there new capabilities that you are going to be, releasing or make available to your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are looking at, again, extending, adding more layers to the onion. So extending the capabilities we already have in both the kind of general collateral type workflows, in the open-ended type workflows. As I said, there's some, stay tuned for some more news on the post-trade side. But also, frankly, because of what we said earlier, we're investing in people. We are adding in the space because it's important for us. Our assets are really people because also technology is made by people. You know, so that it's you know, we do see a very interesting opportunity in this marketplace. It's a very big TAM, not very electronified, and with a lot, as I said, of complexities, workflow challenges to solve. And we think we know we do well in those situations. So we'll continue to invest in that space.
Are you using any technologies, I guess, to let's say maybe AI or machine learning that you know, pick up some of the insights that of the activity that happened on your platform?
Yeah, we're looking at it. We're looking at it, and it's a great question actually, because I forgot to mention one of the benefits of electronification in the repo market, in every market, but in repo, is the ability to digitize the workflow, right? And when you digitize the workflow, you can contextualize that workflow with data surrounding it, right? Both the execution data and the surrounding data. So we are looking at analytics to help a client execution, and we are very close to. In fact, we're literally about to go out with a beta version for a couple of clients that have expressed interest, and then we'll refine the product and make it a real one in the next few weeks.
Could you give me an example of what it actually does?
It enhances the pre-trade transparency in the marketplace by trying to estimate where a curve could be.
So how do you use those technologies to actually point to that curve, to where that curve might be?
Is it like you look at contextualizing the execution, really, like it gets a little technical, complicated, and the interesting thing of this element though is like data gets almost like a fuel to the automation. The moment you have more data, more analytics, you can benchmark the execution. Then there is a better way to direct the electronic flow, and that's really what we're trying to do all the time. It's like a virtuous cycle, right? You start from the execution, and then you come back always to the execution.
Okay. And earlier, right at the beginning of this conversation, you did also say that you are all in charge of data strategies, right? I mean, just to perhaps give me an overview, like what, could you give me an example of how you execute, what Tradeweb's data strategy is, particularly for the repo market, and how are you executing on that?
So it's a great question. So for us, like data has two elements, right? One element of how can we improve the execution experience, the electronic execution experience, by leveraging our data set and contextualizing that execution. And that's one element of that. And the other element is to create analytics that we can distribute to clients, or pricing that we can distribute to clients. And that really are the two cornerstones, like how can data improve and accelerate electronification, right? And the execution on the platform. And also, is there analytics we can and pricing the points that we can distribute to clients? And these are the two cornerstones in general.
So that's really, I mean, on that second point, the creating the analytics, that's really to that beta project that you're currently working on with clients, right?
For example, yes, that's one of those.
Yeah. When, now that it's in beta, I'm sure that there's still some work involved in that before you actually put it into production. When do you foresee that you'll do that?
It really depends on the feedback, right? So we are very much of a collaborative innovators, right? So when we do, like, for us, like this kind of way of creating a product, whether it's a data product, an execution product, is very common. So we identify a problem, come up with an idea about the solution, then we iterate. And the iteration kind of depends on the feedback, as sometimes the kind of problem set kind of changes once you have a first solution, right? And then you can, maybe you can find the solution to a different type of problem. So we iterate, and as we iterate, then we improve the product, and then finally we put it to market. But so it's a little, at this stage in the development, it's a bit kind of difficult to anticipate, but we're very used to it because, as I said, at our core is this belief that innovation only happens if you do it collaboratively with clients and trying to address a specific problem.
I'm just curious. I mean, in terms of because the beta is available to a specific set of clients, right? I mean, how many clients are involved in that at the moment?
like a handful of clients. It's demanding also for the customer base, right? You need to really have an open discussion with the customers, right? They'll have to take a look at it, understand, and give us feedback. It's an involved process, which is great because then the product has real user input from the beginning.
Okay, that's cool. Well, this has been quite an insightful conversation that we've been having. Now, I'd like to, I guess, now end on a slightly lighter note. So earlier this week when we were chatting, and I'm very proud to say as a Malaysian that you actually love durian. And it's one of the, I don't know whether I should say very few things, but it's one of the few things. Yeah, it's one of the things that make me proud to be a Malaysian, that we, as a country, we produce one of the best durian fruits in the whole wide world.
I couldn't agree more. Yes, it's an interesting experience with durian. The first time you smell it, really, it's a bit off-putting. But then if you put yourself past that moment of the smell and you taste it, it's so deliciously sweet, like anything else you've ever tried. And I said my wife loves the fruit, and the other day she was saying, well, I have done a research, and to your point, and I have found out that the best durian in the world are in Malaysia. So I think there's a lot of stuff to see in Malaysia anyway, so I think we should try and arrange a trip to Malaysia with the family. And I have three kids. The oldest two, they really don't like the smell or the taste. They tried it, fair play. And the youngest one likes the smell, believe it or not, and obviously the taste. So we know who's gonna go to the tour with the durian tasting event with us if we ever make that trip. But if we do, I will ask for advices around touring Malaysia.
I'll happily give you advice or even take you myself if I can. it's really interesting because I didn't actually grow up really liking durian, but now I love it. I'm just curious because a lot of usually when I speak to someone living in the UK or US or even Australia, New Zealand, when they describe durian to me, that the equivalent description, I guess, a lot of them would say it kind of reminds them of blue cheese. Do you agree with that, or is there a better way to put it?
I'm Italian, so I have to say gorgonzola cheese. Yes, very similar. It's a off-putting smell at the beginning, and then you go past it, and it's delicious. Definitely, I would say very similar. But the thing is, like, obviously, like the cheese is saltiness and creaminess and stuff. The sweetness of durian is incredible. I would recommend to everybody, try. I even learned how to open it, which is tricky.
Oh, wow.
Tricky.
Do you get, I'm guessing you do get frozen ones over where you are, right?
Yeah, you can get fresh ones as well.
I
have to say, though, they're mostly Thai.
Mm-mm.
Which is great as well, but according to my wife, Dutch Malaysia is number one.
Yay! Okay, I mean, we could carry on talking about durian forever, and repo markets too. But it's been great to have you on, Enrico. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to speak with me, and we look to having you back soon.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity. Very exciting. Thanks a lot.